From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Nicole Jolly works at a hospital in Paradise, California. Last week, the state's most deadly wildfire forced Jolly and the entire town to evacuate. This is what she saw.
The lights in front of me, on the vehicle in front of me, they were melting. And I called my husband, and I'm crying hysterically, and I said, Nick, I'm going to die. I can't get out of my car. It's on fire. I'm going to die. And he says, don't die. Run.
Most of Paradise was reduced to ashes in what's become California's deadliest ever fire. In fact, in little over a year, the state has endured record-breaking fires, the deadliest, the most costly, and the largest in state history. That's why California Governor Jerry Brown says,
this is not the new normal. This is the new abnormal. And this new abnormal will continue.
Continue because of climate change, development, land use management, a whole host, a complex web of causes that have one thing in common: human activity. This hour on Point, what can be done about California's seemingly endless fire season? And you can join us. Have these fires affected you or your family or someone you know in California? How can we prevent these kinds of fires that seem to grow more deadly, more devastating every year? Or if they're inevitable, yes, wildfires are part of the natural landscape in much of America, but how can we mitigate the effects? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today from Northern California, the site of the massive campfire, as it's called, is Deputy Chief Scott McLean. He is Chief of Information for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, or CAL FIRE, and he joins us from Chico, California. Scott McLean, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking some time to join us today. First of all, can you just tell us sort of what is the status, of the campfire right now?
Well, the campfire did increase over the course of the night. We're at 125,000 acres, 30% contained. And then the containment has gone up, so that's good news. Keep in mind that it's a very rugged terrain that these firefighters are having to deal with right now, as well as the weather. Into a certain aspect, but the weather is looking progressively much better as the days go on now. The red flag warnings have been canceled. Minimal winds, watching the news this morning, we're looking probably 3 to 5 mile per hour winds over most of the fire. Some gusts up to 15 on other parts. So that's a lot less than there was before.
Okay.
The vegetation is still extremely dry. Humidities continue to climb. We're getting what we call humidity recovery over the course of the night. So there's a little bit more moisture in the air, which impedes the fire as well.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about what this fire is like? We heard that clip a little earlier from Nicole Jolly, the resident in Paradise, about how close she came to dying because of the fire. We know that the fire has claimed the lives of dozens of people. I mean, how large is it? How hot is it? I mean, have you seen anything like this in your experience?
No. I was in the middle of it the first day with all the firefighters and law enforcement. It was nighttime. It basically night. Day turned into night starting about 9 o'clock in the morning, and that's where it stayed for the rest of the day into the night, of course. At times, you just could not see, the nose in front of your face. It was that smoked in.
Wow. I have to say, if you don't mind me saying, you and your fellow firefighters are working so hard. I can hear the fatigue in your voice right now. Are firefighters getting the support they need? Are there enough people? Tell us a little bit about that.
Overall, as far as we're getting between 16 and 17 states are sending us resources into the state of California. Earlier this year, about the same did so, and we had just under 14,000 individuals assigned to the fires earlier on this year. We're dealing with basically three fires down to two fires, the Woolsey and the campfire, of course. We're going to see a lot more resources continue to come in to support us. The firefighters definitely are giving it their all. They know what it's at stake, and they want to take care of that situation. They want to mitigate it ASAP for the public that we serve.
Yeah. Mr. McLean, one more question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to say that it seems as if California now has crossed into having a fire season that doesn't end?
We don't have a fire season. There's no season anymore.
Meaning what?
Year round. We have on average that folks don't realize right now, in the latter part of this year, we have roughly anywhere from 100 to 200 wildland fire starts every week on average. Now, those are kept relatively small to 10 acres or less. So it's a constant battle. Right now, I believe it was last week, we were about 100, memory serves me, about 111 starts. I'll be getting the stats out again this morning on what we're looking at as far as today, up to date. So it's a constant fight.
What's that doing to the state?
In reference to what?
Well, I mean, California is a huge, important state, but can the state cope with being in a endless fire season?
It's difficult. I'm not going to, make it any less important. We all have to work together. It's a team effort due to the public, the law enforcement, fire services up and down the state. We have a fantastic system in place called Master Mutual Aid System.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we keep using it, every month, which we didn't. So the protection is there. The resources are there and can respond, from out of state, as we keep proving, out of the country as well. So it's hard to say. We are, forestry department as well, CAL FIRE is. Prevention's a big part of this as well. We are continuing trying to bring our force back to resiliency. We're doing prescribed burns. We're doing fuel reduction projects, a myriad of different things. But keep in mind, too, the drought from 2012 to 2017, it really hasn't stopped, honestly.
Right.
We're looking at over 129 million dead trees plus that we're contending with as well. So through the bark beetle, through the lack of nutrients in the soil and to feed the vegetation. So it's just an ongoing thing. We need significant winters for several years to come to bring California back onto that plateau as far as making our forests healthy, curbing these wildland fires along with our prevention projects.
Well, Scott McLean is Deputy Chief and Chief of Information for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, or CAL FIRE, speaking to us today from Chico, California. Mr. McLean, thank you so much. Thank you to all the firefighters who are working hard to protect people in California. And thank you for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, as you heard Deputy Chief McLean say, they are fighting, as he said, hundreds of fires every week now on various scales in California. We've been talking about what's happened in Paradise, California, not far, just a little bit east of where Deputy McLean was in Chico, California. Most of Paradise burned to the ground, 80% of it gone. And in an interview with Sacramento TV station KTXL just yesterday, Paradise Mayor Jody Jones described the scope of the devastation.
It's pretty devastating. It's huge. I would say 90% of our homes are gone. The entire town council lost their homes, half of our police department, most of our town administrative staff, just about every friend I know.
So it's rare for somebody to have a place to go home to.
Yes, it is rare.
That's Jody Jones, the mayor of Paradise, California. Joining us now from Sacramento is Ryan Lillis, reporter for the Sacramento Bee. He's covered most of Northern California's fires for the past 12 years. And he joined us, by the way, in August for an update on the Mendocino Complex fire and other fires across the Golden State earlier this summer. He joins us again. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first of all, you heard Deputy Chief Scott McLean there. I just was really taken by the sound of the weariness in his voice. California as a whole must be exhausted by this, what seems like an endless fire season now.
Yeah, absolutely. There are fires, as you said, in Southern California as well. Here in Sacramento, an hour and a half away from Paradise, schools are being canceled because of the smoke, but it's clearly not anywhere near what they're experiencing up in Paradise and in Chico. And, this week it's Paradise. Last summer it was Redding, California, and Lakeport. The year before that it was Santa Rosa. These aren't tiny towns that no one's heard of. These are places that many, many people in Northern California have deep connections to, and they're being devastated every year.
So that's one of the big differences that we're seeing in recent years, that the fires are all, I mean, people have always been at risk, but now we're having, like you said, larger cities, towns being affected. But places like Paradise, though, for example, even had wildfire evacuation plans set up. But if I understand correctly, in Paradise, the plan was to evacuate the town in sections. But this fire, the campfire moved so fast and sent so many embers miles ahead of it that their evacuation plan fell apart.
Yeah, it overwhelmed the town. They had, in 2008, I was there in the summer of 2008, they had two fires. It was actually, Cal Fire still refers to it as the 2008 siege, where a series of lightning storms set off dozens of fires in Northern California. And two of them came right up to the border of Paradise, destroyed some houses in kind of the rural areas. And after that, the town leaders got together. They split Paradise into geographic zones, several zones. And the thought was that they would evacuate one zone at a time or two zones at a time when a fire was approaching. They also held mock evacuations during rush hour. They closed down streets. There's only four ways out of town to the south towards safety, four roads. And they basically opened up one to traffic in both directions during a rush hour to do this evacuation. I talked to an expert over the weekend who said they were as prepared or more prepared than any town he's ever heard of in Northern California. But this fire moved through that town so fast, it didn't even burn the trees. It just went from house to house. And like you said, leveled 80-90% of the town.
Wow. Well, Ryan Lillis, reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Anytime.
We're talking about California's now endless fire season, why climate change, human development, land use management, all of it is contributing to a new abnormal in California and across much of the West. We'll be back with more. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about California's now year-round fire season. The state is battling its deadliest fires right now, having killed in Northern California, having already killed dozens of people, destroyed more than 6,000 buildings. It's sort of the confluence of lots of factors: climate change, human development, land use management, even local micro weather patterns, long-term drought in California, all coming together to produce a new reality in the West that you can look at it from this point of view, say this is climate change come home to roost right here in our own backyards. I mean, listen to how Greg Brock, he's a resident in Point Doom, California. He left his home on Friday to escape the Woolsey Fire in Southern California. His house was fine, but he told NPR's All Things Considered yesterday the devastation in his neighborhood was brutal.
Entire streets are just leveled, and there was at one point there was a huge diesel truck, and it was molten, just a flow of molten metal behind it, about 10-12 feet. The fire was so hot, and there'd be four houses gone, then one fine, and then four houses gone, and it was bad. The whole hill, everything is gone.
That's Greg Brock in Southern California, and we want to hear from you. What do you think? How do we manage this new reality of a forever fire season in California and much of the American West? How does climate change and where we choose to build our cities and our towns and our homes factor into all of this? And of course, the president brought up forest management. What's your view on the role that has to play in the American West? And joining me now from Thousand Oaks, California, is Glenn McDonald. He's professor of geography and ecology at the University of California, Los Angeles. He spent decades studying climate change and the effects of wildfires. He and his family evacuated from their homes just last week because of the Woolsey Fire in Southern California. Professor McDonald, welcome to On Point. Professor McDonald, are you there? Well, we'll see if we can connect with him shortly. We're also joined today from Berkeley, California, by J. Keith Gillis. He is a professor of forest economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's chair of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection. That's CAL FIRE's policy board. J. Keith Gillis, welcome to you.
Hello.
Hi. So first of all, tell us your view of the scale of the fires right now in California. All the descriptions we've seen and heard put them amongst the state's largest and deadliest. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a real tragedy.
So, I mean, how would you describe how we got to this place? It seems as if year after year now, during every fire season, the season gets longer, and we keep talking about the deadliest, the biggest, the largest. Is the trajectory only going to go in one way?
The trajectory for the risk we face from climate change will go in one way, at least for our lifetime. But some of this is under our control. The weather isn't, but dealing with the way that we move into the wildlands, creating wildland-urban interface and the zoning and building codes that we use there, the way in which we fund or simply rely on the market to do vegetation management to reduce the fuel loading, that's under our control. The degree to which we come up with better ways to notify people and evacuate them, I think CAL FIRE deserves some real credit in the last couple of years for doing a good job on providing actionable information in concert with local officials. But, you know, the fatalities are normally in the early parts of the fire. And so we can always do better, I think, on notification. And certainly we've had reason to doubt whether reliance on opt-in notification systems is really going to provide the leverage we need.
Okay. So, Professor Gillis, if we can, I was wondering if we could just sort of zero in on a couple of different areas that are contributing to the ever-growing fire season or you know, as we heard the deputy fire chief for CAL FIRE tell us earlier, the year-round fire season now in California. I mean, first of all, let's just go right at what President Trump tweeted a little while back that he says forest management bad management is part of the problem here. Your reaction to that, your evaluation of that?
I believe I said in one interview that that comment was at best uninformed. And the lead-in for your show today talked about the complexity of the situation. It is too complex to reduce to a tweet. The fact that roughly 60% of the forests in the state are under federal management, whereas the board I chair writes, I think, the toughest forest practice rules in the country, dealing only with private land, says already it's a complex policy environment. There is something close to a consensus. It is not a complete consensus in the forestry community that our forests are overstocked.
Right.
And that creates some real policy issues because we're also looking in California to lead the nation on climate policy. And, you know, if we're looking to forests as a possible way to sequester carbon, you have to balance their ability to sequester carbon in standing forests with the fact that the higher the stocking, the greater the fire risk to that carbon that's on the landscape. So we have competing social objectives here that make this not exactly a straightforward solution. We're going to find our way forward, but there's public safety, there's climate policy, there's protection of wildlife habitat, protection of water courses. It's pretty complex.
Yeah. I mean, so just so you know, I grew up in the state to the north of you. I grew up in Oregon, so I've got some familiarity with the complexity around forest management here. And you know, the sort of a top-level criticism that you touched on that people have had for some time is, you know, that overstocked forest issues that perhaps, you know, we haven't – some people think we haven't been letting enough, you know, clearing of trees or sort of selected targeted reduction of the amount of fuel, but the thing I'm wondering though is that that is part of the picture, perhaps in places like Northern California, but in Southern California, we're not talking about forests per se, right? We're talking about brush and scrubland, but that's also loaded with, you know, so you're not going to just cut all that down, but it's still loaded with this incredibly dry fuel that's high volume and like, you know, like tinder for because of a drought that the state's been undergoing for years.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And lumping it all as a forestry problem as opposed to a fire management problem is really overly simplistic. And what you would like the role of fire to be on the landscape is quite different in different parts of the state. The fire return interval in a wet forest like a redwood forest on the North Coast is very different than the fire return interval perhaps in the Sierra Nevada where these fires are taking place, where, you know, a fire return interval of 7 to 12 years mm-hmm. would be about the right return interval, whether from fire or through vegetation management to serve as a surrogate for fire. In Southern California, there are some of the shrubland ecosystems where the natural fire return interval is much longer because of the marine influence. And repeated fire on the landscape can actually be quite damaging to some of those chaparral systems right on the coast. It's a little different inland. So you need a locally nuanced solution. And frankly, you're going to run into as to whether it's a mechanical treatment to reduce the fuel loading or reintroducing fire. We have the Clean Air Act, and
right.
California has real challenges with managing the air. And that whole issue of whether or not it's better from a public health standpoint to have a burst of particulates with fires or have a level of non-attainment but lower because of sort of spread out prescribed fire activity is still an open one and
right.
wasn't one ever envisioned by the Congress when it passed the Clean Air Act.
Right. Well, Professor Gillis, stand by here for just a second because it looks like now we have Glenn McDonald on the line with us from Thousand Oaks, California. As I mentioned, he's a professor of geography and ecology at the University of California, Los Angeles. And he and his family had to evacuate their homes last week because of the Woolsey Fire in Southern California. So, Professor McDonald, are you with us now?
I am indeed with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm sorry about the technical glitch that we suffered there for a couple of minutes. But tell us, first of all, you just had to evacuate last week. What was that like?
Well, you know, you sort of study these things and look at this. But when it actually happens to you, it suddenly becomes very, very real. We had been at the vigil for the 12 people who were killed at the borderline
yeah.
shooting here.
Yeah.
And came home and were in bed, and about 11:20 at night, we all of a sudden, all our phones started ringing, including my daughter's, who doesn't live with us anymore as an adult, with a voluntary evacuation order. I took a look. We could see the red of the glow on the ridgeline behind our home, and I said, okay, this is serious, and we started to pack. And we had a plan, and people should have a plan. Grabbed what we could, put it in there. We then made sure that everyone was safe and out. And my son and I then went back. Now we were under mandatory evacuation, and we sealed up all the vents leading into our attic. The
uh-huh.
reason being is that this is one of the major reasons that structures burn, is that embers get sucked into the attic spaces. They sit there unnoticed, and then they cause the house to burn out from the inside. And at that point, the police were traveling around and basically using, you know, their PA systems on their vehicles to tell everyone to get out. The glow was much, much brighter. It had come to the backyards of some of our friends, and our friends indeed evacuated with us and stayed at my son's house with us. And then we just had to ride it out. And And you realize that, you know, you sort of need a plan. And we're very fortunate. We're in a semi-suburban setting, so there's lots of different routes to get out. But you also realize that in some of the canyons and places where you have limited routes to get out, how quickly this can all happen.
How's your house? Professor McDonald, do you know?
Yes, okay.
Is your house still standing?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, our house is standing, and we're very, very pleased about that. The couple that evacuated with us, their house is standing. They lost their fence, but their neighbor's house is completely gone. And this is the way it happens in this sort of urban wildland interface, particularly when the fire then enters into what we would consider a more suburban landscape. It becomes less predictable in some senses. You know, it's what your landscaping is, how flammable it is, if embers can get into your attic space. So you'll have rows of houses, which are fine, and then there'll be a house which lit on fire.
Wow.
In the case of Santa Rosa, those houses then, with the Tubbs fire, they served as sort of fire inoculation sources. Houses burn really hot. If they're close together, they throw a lot of embers. If the landscaping around your house is vulnerable, then that the house that started burning at the end of your block is the one that leads to your house burning.
Wow. Professor McDonald and Professor Gillis, I want to play a little bit of tape here because we were talking with Professor Gillis a minute ago about the role that land use management, both on forests and other types of land in the West, the role that's playing in these devastating fires. But also beyond that, let's just talk about climate change, because at a press conference on Sunday, California Governor Jerry Brown said that federal and state governments have to do more when it comes to land use management, but that climate change is a greater cause of these problems.
Managing all the forests in every way we can does not stop climate change. And those who deny that are definitely contributing to the tragedies that we're now witnessing and will continue to witness.
Professor McDonald, how is climate change, or what role is climate change playing in California's endless fire season now?
Yeah, well, if we go back to what Scott said, our fire season, particularly in Southern California, this wouldn't be true in the high elevations of the Sierras or something, but in Southern California, it is a year-round fire season. And in the 20th century, we did have late season fires and things like that. But we are getting fires now in January, February, things like that. What we can see is that 15 of the 20 largest wildfires in the state have occurred since the year 2000. This has been in tandem with increasing temperatures and with record-breaking temperatures. And what we've done is we've extended that fire season. Remember, we have a climate where we get our precipitation in the winter, and then for most of the state, extremely dry summer, which allows your fuels then to dry out, and they become progressively drier as you move through the summer season. Well, imagine with higher temperatures, spring comes earlier. That process of drying becomes, earlier. The higher temperatures that we're experiencing accelerates that process of drying. And then, this is important for areas like Southern California where we have the Santa Ana winds, these large winds, gusty winds that develop in the fall and in the early winter, or Northern California, their counterpart, the Diablo winds. The drier that fuel is at that time of year with those winds, the more volatile the situation. And then the high temperatures keep the fire season longer into the fall, which for us in Southern California with Santa Ana's and Diablo's mean we're facing our greatest threat being extended further into the winter.
Wow.
It really is a triple whammy.
I'm also seeing here, there's at least some studies that point that to the fact that Northern California's climate is getting warmer such that it may match current day Southern California temperatures by the end of this decade?
Well, you know, this remains to be seen. The rate of climate warming in places like the Southwest seems to be remarkably fast and seems to have accelerated. Now, we have to look at, you know, there's a combination of increasing greenhouse gases and there's a certain degree of natural variability. So I think we'll have to wait and see. But it's certainly the case that as we move towards the end of the century, we're going to see, a shifting of these fire danger zones.
Mm.
If I might say, this is the problem with the concept, this is the new normal or the new abnormal. this isn't a stationary target. We haven't arrived at the station yet. This train is continuing to move. And as we pump more CO2 and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, as temperatures rise, this is going to exacerbate the situation. So We ain't seeing the end of this yet.
Well, Professor Gillis, we've just got about 30 seconds here before the break, but I wanted to bring you back in here. What do you, what's your response to what Professor McDonald's saying?
Well, he's right on point. We can't assume anything static about the environment we're in. It's been changing long before there were people here, and it'll change because of our activities and climate as they influence climate change.
All right. Well, when we come back from a quick break, we'll talk about maybe, targeted things that we can do about this. I'm speaking with J. Keith Gillis and Glenn McDonald. They're both professors in California, and we're talking about California's now year-round fire season. It's not really limited to California. Much of the American West has to deal with this. So what do you think? What can we do to mitigate and manage what Professor McDonald just talked about as a moving target? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the massive wildfires burning in California right now and what's turning into California's year-round fire season. I'm joined today by Glenn McDonald. He's a professor of geography and ecology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and by J. Keith Gillis. He's a professor of forest economics at the University of California, Berkeley. We're looking at climate change and land use management and human development, all of these things put together leading California to where it is now, facing devastating fire after fire. What can we do about it? Professors McDonald and Gillis, let me just let some callers in here because they've been very patient thus far. So let's go to Jim, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello. I used to live in Southern California and Northern California and still have relatives at both ends. One of the questions I have for Dr. McDonald and Dr. Gillis is, what do you think about expanding the use of goats in the urban wildland interface for vegetation management and reducing the fuel load?
Jim, thanks for your call. Professor Gillis, let me start with you. What do you think?
Well, sure. Goats on a per acre basis are pretty expensive, but they have great social acceptance. And there are applications where putting fire on the landscape is never going to be socially acceptable. They use goats right here within a mile of where I'm sitting up at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And so there is a role for them, but it's a rather high-cost solution.
Right. Well, so to the point about sort of broader scale land management, we have a lot of listeners online who want to ask the simple question. For example, Jay, someone calling themselves Jay on Twitter, says, ask about the history of fire and forest management. For decades, the strategy was to prevent all fires, not understanding or perhaps denying that fire is a natural part of the ecosystem. Now, too much growth, and with climate change, it's drier and hotter. So, Professor Gillis, I mean, not for a long time, not allowing natural burns or even perhaps not having enough controlled burns. Is it time to rethink that?
Absolutely. And as Professor McDonald can add, we're going to have more fire in the landscape. In a Mediterranean climate like we're in, it's just going to have to be there. And suppression isn't when we talk about preventing fires, there's a lot to preventing fires which is not ecologically at odds with living in harmony with our environment. You know, Cal Fire is doing now defensible space inspections on homes. That's part of fire prevention. The compliance we're working with through the State Board of Forestry and Fire Protection and the Land Use Planning Group and Cal Fire to bring all county and local entities' fire safety elements in compliance with the fire safety regulations on emergency access, water reserves, vegetation management, signage. All of that's part of prevention. So there's a lot we do that isn't about suppression, and an emphasis on prevention, which is, you know, the precursor to suppression activities. That's where a lot of this is going to pay off if we're going to make social investments, and that's where the state's putting a lot of money.
Yeah.
They're going to put $1 billion on the table for vegetation management and prevention activities over the next 5 years.
So, Professor McDonald, pick up on that thought, because another thing that I wanted to explore with both of you is, you know, maybe in years past or generations past, we could have said, well, people shouldn't be building in places that are much more susceptible to wildfires in the West. But the difference we're seeing now is I'm just thinking about what happened in Paradise. That's a town of 27,000 people. 80% of it is gone now. So, I mean, we can't even – maybe we should still be talking about, you know, where we're putting human habitation in these zones between between the built and natural environment. But it seems as if it's gone beyond that, that we're having entire towns and cities that are already existing that are now under threat.
Well, I'd say a couple things on that. One is any place that you build at low elevations in California, you're going to be up against flammable fuels and ecosystems, which typically carry fires. That's just sort of the way it is. The other thing I would mention is that if you study the history of fire and development in North America, this is in Canada and the United States, there were some massive city-destroying fires that did occur in the 19th century and the early 20th century. So this is not necessarily something completely new. I think that we will have to look at the placement of some of our development in terms of these fuels, where you're going to have difficulties with egress by roads or things like that. And I think that probably there'll be a market solution to a certain degree in terms of you simply can't get insurance to build there. Mm-hmm. There probably will have to be regulations. Municipalities, the state, are very, very good about going after things like no longer allowing you to put wood shake roofs and flammable roofing, which is the situation here in Thousand Oaks. Our defensible perimeters. I visited a lot of the sites which, with the fire, the Wolseley fire came up to here in Westlake Village, Thousand Oaks area. And those large community defensible perimeters between the subdivisions and then between the chaparral or coastal sage scrub, they really did a number. And that's where, you know, the caller mentioned goats. Okay, so typically this is done mechanically. It's done in the early spring before the fuels are flammable. But those things worked. Also, if you take a look at what's burning, you know, newer building stock with stucco exteriors, maybe a little bit less venting. They have tile roofs. The landscaping's not so flammable. Mm. You know, the individual home in terms of its construction and its landscaping are also important. We're not going to get away from fire. We're not going to put out every fire, nor should we, because it serves for important ecological functions. We really have to look about our overall community planning. But we will never get away from having our communities in some way or the other adjacent to flammability. And then we have to look at our individual structures. Well, and finally, evacuation. Evacuation and early warning. This has got to be critical, and we've seen this in Paradise.
Well, yeah, so as we mentioned earlier in the hour, Paradise after 2008 had a comprehensive evacuation plan, right? And perhaps one of the best in the state of California. But because of the sudden and total nature of the embers that fell on the Paradise before the campfire actually got to the city, that even their extreme preparation wasn't enough, right? Because they were thinking about evacuating people in neighborhoods or in sections, but everyone had to end up leaving the city at once. So, I mean, is that, are we going to have, I guess we are going to have plans now where you're looking at emptying out in, entire cities instantaneously?
Well, if I might, you had 250,000 people were under mandatory evacuation orders here in Southern California. I think they exercise an abundance of caution. People might argue, well, my neighborhood didn't seem to be that threatened yet. I had to spend 2 or 3 days someplace else. I think Paradise is a great example of that. With these high winds, with these embers, it's not like this front is slowly moving towards you.
Right.
And so I do think that this sort of early warning, and it is uncomfortable and it is disruptive. But I'd rather be uncomfortable and disrupted and be alive.
It's the same thing that people on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast face when with approaching hurricanes, I guess. Professor Gillis, you wanted to chime in there.
Yeah, just a couple quick things. Your reference to hurricanes is right on point. The natural hazards literature of the country has lots of lessons you can share across natural hazards. And, you know, one of the unique things we're in right now is that we've had so many instances of fire is that the public mindset about fire in California is rather different than its response to natural hazards you experience once in a lifetime or once in, you know, every other generation, like a magnitude 7
earthquake.
So it does provide you with the social capital to make change when you've had fire seasons, the kind we have in California. One thing I wanted to add to Professor McDonald's point on, yes, everywhere in California we say it'll all burn. The question is when and how intensely. There are some studies coming out of the geography community that I'm very impressed with that look at the role of Diablo or Santa Ana winds and topography creating particularly dangerous corridors. And so it could be that the as we zone out the fire hazard in the state, there are some areas that may be subjected repeatedly to extreme events. And in those cases, we're going to have to be really very rigorous in our design of the transportation network, in our requirements for fire-resilient housing and vegetation management. And the Tubbs fire is a good example of that, where a fire can basically be recreated and you look at the weather conditions and you look at the topography and you say, ah, I see why that happened.
Wow. Well, you know, since you mentioned the Santa Ana winds, I just want to play a little bit of tape here. This is from KCAL-TV. You'll hear reporter Kara Finstrom reporting from Malibu just yesterday, talking about the winds that could hinder progress in battling the Woolsey fire in Southern California.
Firefighters here telling us they do feel they made some progress over the weekend when the Santa Anas died down as far as containing this massive fire. But they're concerned about the Santa Anas picking up again, and we're starting to feel them out here around midday.
Let's go to a quick call. Andy is calling from New Orleans. Andy, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. First and foremost, my heart goes out to anyone who's lost their home. You're in a club that nobody wants to be in, you never thought you'd be in, and I've been in it before, and it really is a horrible, horrible feeling. You'll be asked constantly, how do you feel about it? Well, you don't even know because it's horrible. Now, the one thing I did learn post-Katrina rebuilding, which we were forced to do, was we looked at what happened in New Orleans, and nobody realizes that we had a lot of fires that ran through here because we had no water pressure, and the fire department was not able to put out a fire when it started. And just as we saw in Hurricane Sandy in Queens, where you had large areas of the cities or certain areas just started on fire, things burned, and they burned uncontrollably and went out. I mean, they just burned completely. And when you look back at your own history, in my city, per se, the French Quarter kept burning over and over and over for centuries. And it didn't stop until the Spanish finally made us put three-hour firewalls. So post-Katrina, I rebuilt with a system that has a three-hour firewall and is fireproof, windproof fireproof, and it's made out of concrete and steel. But my biggest issue is when I go to a big box store and I go and I see how America builds, I can get a piece of wood or a 2x4 that's 8 or 10 feet long for maybe $2.50. That is ridiculous. I wonder what percentage of that 2x4 is covered by whether some form of tax breaks where we have everyone saying, oh, wow, great, we're growing trees.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're eating greenhouse gas.
Forgive me for interrupting you, but I got to jump in here because I need to say I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is on point. Professor McDonald, I think what Andy was headed towards, and sorry I had to cut him off there, but that, you know, he's seeing that we're subsidizing the wrong kind of building products, wood, if we want to really get more resilient fireproof building practices out there. What do you think?
Well, you know, again, the state of California and many, many jurisdictions, you're not allowed to use wood shakes and shingles on your roofing. And I suspect there'll be more regulation like that in terms of the flammability of exterior material. Decking is another area where some areas you're simply not allowed to use wood decking anymore because of its flammability. So I think we will look at that, how that fits into forest subsidies. What is the mix between things like wood versus cinder block and other materials in building? I mean, that's an area really that I think maybe Professor Gillis could answer more from the policy standpoint.
Well, Professor Gillis, hang on here for just a second because there's one more caller I want to get to before we return to you, because Lori is calling from Chico, California. Lori, you're on the air. How are you doing?
Hi. Pretty shocked. I have a little bit of a story to tell if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah, I hate to say this, Lori, but we've just got about a minute and a half. But tell us all that you can in that time.
Okay, so what happened is for about 2 days, PG&E, our electricity company here, had been advertising on the TV and sending out text messages that we were going to be in a high fire danger, and so that they would be turning off the power. And on the day of the fire started on the PG&E lines. The power wasn't even shut off. And then it just escalated into Paradise and into Magalia, is the town that I live in. We never had emergency responders. We never got any evacuation notice. And up until about 11:30 or maybe 12, the power was still on in Magalia.
Huh.
So I don't know what these stories are that are going around saying everything worked per plan. Absolutely not. People were running for their lives.
Wow. Well, Lori, first of all, by the fact that you're able to call us, I'm glad that you're safe. And thank you so much for sharing your experience. That's Lori calling us from Chico, California. Professor Gillis, we really do have just about 45 seconds here to go. And this is a huge topic, right? It's complex and it's huge. But I was just wondering if you have a last thought to leave us with about California's new reality. Here.
I'm going to go off of Lori's comment. Everyone that lives in these areas, go to CAL FIRE's website, look at the Ready, Set, Go process. And part of this is planning, but plans, the best laid plans, don't necessarily get implemented. But everyone needs to be prepared for a fire. Yeah. And let's avoid simplistic logic. Even things as simple as why build with something that's flammable? Well, we have other social objectives as well, that the carbon footprint of steel and concrete are not necessarily something that we should be advocating at the same time that we're dealing with fire management.
You know, but I also keep thinking that while it may be simplistic, it's also true that this is yet another example of how climate change, you know, at a top level is really changing the way we all have to live. J. Keith Gillis, professor of forest economics at the University of California, Berkeley, joining us today from Berkeley. Thank you so much for being with us, professor.
My great pleasure.
And Glenn McDonald, professor of geography and ecology at the University of California, Los Angeles, with us today from Thousand Oaks, California. Professor McDonald, thank you so much and all the best to you and your family.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.